I will call this remote hearing of the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is January 11th, 2022. This meeting is being held remotely in accordance with Rule 10.01, which allows us to do this remotely and is being recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. Today is going to be, as I said, it's going to be an informational hearing. Wanted to really lift up this issue before we really get into the heat of session when there are many, many more things to be distracted by. And so today we'll be hearing from Civil Legal Services as well as the Board of Public Defense and public defenders themselves. And one thing kind of housekeeping to mention to members is that we do have a new committee administrator as of November. Rachel Ghanani took another position, and we now have Bryn Sias is my new committee administrator. So just if you want to update your notes as far as reaching out to the committee, she and Anna will continue to be the folks to reach out to as far as scheduling and anything else that you need to get accomplished with the committee. So did want to note that. And with that, we will move right into the presentation from Civil Legal Services. We have a couple presenters here today. First on the list, I have Dori Rappaport. Ms. Rappaport, if you want to, oh, I see you've already got your camera on. If you want to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then you can go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Dori Rappaport. I'm the Executive Director of Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Just ahead. Yeah, go ahead. I wasn't sure if you guys were taking turns or going back and forth, but go ahead, Ms. Hefkin, and introduce yourself, and then you guys can go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Ann Hefkin. I am the Executive Director of Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota, and I am going to go ahead and hopefully share my screen. Thank you again for the time that you've granted us this afternoon. We are here on behalf of the Civil Legal Services across all of Minnesota. And I know we did speak to this committee a year ago, not me, but Ms. Rappaport and Drew Schaefer. So I am going to start with just a little bit of an overview of who we are and what we do before we get into some more numbers. We are a coalition of nonprofit organizations, nonprofit law firms that provide free legal information, support, and representation to low-income individuals and seniors all across the state of Minnesota. Our coalition of six regional programs reaches all 87 counties of Minnesota, along with our partner programs that have more targeted audiences that they serve. And as the slide shows, some of the regional programs cover huge geographic areas, but it's important that we do cover every county and provide services in every county in Minnesota. The types of services that we provide are on civil legal issues that impact people's most basic critical needs. So family stability and safety, housing stability, income stability, access to healthcare and education. Those are the types of cases that we handle. That's what our lawyers deal with. These are non-criminal cases. We are the other side of the system from the public defenders. And so who do we serve? We serve individuals who are at or below functionally 125% of federal poverty guidelines. And as you can see, for a family of four, that's just over $33,000 a year. So it's an extremely low-income families that we serve. We focus on basic, critical human needs. In 2020, we served over 90,000 Minnesotans, again, in every single county across the state, and we closed over 40,000 legal cases as a system. We disproportionately provide representation to people of color because they are disproportionately represented in the low-income communities. And so as the slide shows, 51% of clients served in 2020 were non-white, and the breakdown is there on the slide. So that's the type of work that we do, and a very, very brief summary of the type of cases that we do. And we'll get into that a little bit more as we move on. And I'm going to pass it off to Dori.
Thanks, Anne. So I want to go back and talk about what's happened since we were here last. And thank you for the increase that Civil Legal Services was granted this last cycle. It has helped us tremendously as we are addressing what's been a salary crisis for Civil Legal Services for quite some time. And as you can see, we are now going to receive an additional $1.2 million for fiscal year 2023, but we're asking for an additional $4.3 million. And I just want to say that when we came to you before to ask for our funding request, the budget of the state was uncertain for all of us. And so we are now telling you what we need. And as we get into this later in the presentation, the salary crisis is really upon us, and you're going to see that when you see our turnover rates. $4.3 million, and if you want to move to the next slide, you can see the difference that $4.3 million will make in our starting salaries, and we're mainly talking about staff attorneys, but this impacts all of our staff. So right now, the average starting salary for staff attorneys is $55,200. And now we're projected with the current increase we'll receive in July to be able to move those starting salaries to $60,335, which is okay. But as you can see, we're still not even at the table with everyone else in the public sector. So our colleagues at the Public Defender's Office are starting at $65,800. Which is still really low in the public sector. But this $4.3 million will allow us to start our staff attorneys at, on average, $65,000. And that's absolutely where we need to be if we're going to continue to keep staff. We also want to talk to you about what we did as a result of the pandemic and moving into this virtual world. So in March of 2020, we, as Legal Aid System, moved virtual, and the courts moved virtual, and we've remained that way. The courts are primarily hearing things in a virtual setting. Legal Aids continue to invest in our technological infrastructure, but what we've seen is the communities that we serve are disproportionately impacted by that digital divide that exists. And so they are expected to attend hearings and access legal services using technology and using the internet, and they don't have it. It's hard. No matter where you are in the state of Minnesota, there's obstacles to accessing legal services and technology. So in 2020, we made a request for CARES Act funding, and that we have called now our Reach Justice Minnesota project. And you'll see here how we expended the almost $3.4 million in CARES Act funds. So we quickly invested in legal kiosks, which Anne will tell you about in a moment, and we spent about $2 million on that. We were able to spend money on emergency temporary staffing at that $570,000 figure, and which was absolutely incredible. And we also were able to purchase four mobile legal aid offices, so justice buses, and Anne will highlight those in a second too. But we also made significant improvements to our statewide website. If you're not familiar, lawhelpmn.org, it's an excellent website. In the last year, over 500,000 people have visited lawhelpmn.org, and they have checked our self-help resources, which we just invested in improving with these CARES Act funds. They viewed those over 800,000 times. This website is a critical investment in giving legal information to the state of Minnesota. So Anne will tell you about our highlights with the legal kiosks and the justice buses.
Yeah, with regards to legal kiosks, what we have created, and it's really a first in the nation innovation that we're really proud of, is a statewide network of these legal kiosks, of these digital access sites. 270 of them across the state of Minnesota, and there are two different versions of them, two different types. So on the left-hand side of your screen, you'll see what we're calling the Model A. Those are kiosks that are in a public location. So for all of the kiosks, we are partnering with community partners, different types of community locations. The Model A, again, the type that you see on the left, are in public locations. So they might be in the lobby of a social services office building. They might be in a shopping mall. They might be in any sort of location that people can go up to the kiosk, get legal information, and also apply immediately for online applications for civil legal aid. So that's a really nice access point. On the other side of the screen, you'll see what we are calling our Model B. And a Model B provides a confidential space, a safe confidential space for people to appear in court. So it offers everything of the Model A plus Zoom capabilities. So we know we got lots of feedback from judges of people appearing in closets and their cars and all of the places that people had to appear because they didn't have an option. This provides people with a safe, confidential place to appear in court or talk to a lawyer or anywhere else they need to appear and appear virtually and remotely and use that. It also has a printer scanner so they can share documents with their attorneys or with the court. And really, it's like a mini virtual courtroom for folks to use. And I will direct you to the legalkiosk.org if anyone's interested in seeing all of the locations of those legal kiosks. You can search by where you are. You can search by location. And they are color-coded A and B based on the blue and green. So it's something we're really, really proud of. And as Dory mentioned, you know, courts went virtual and they're staying virtual. This is not something that's going away. And I think it's an infrastructure and a network that is going to serve the communities really well into the future. Another aspect of our Reach Justice is our mobile legal aid clinics. And we have some pictures here. They were at the Capitol this summer and we launched them in August. They are fully equipped legal offices. They have a lift in the back so that they're accessible for people with disabilities, and they can go to anywhere that the need for technology and Wi-Fi and outreach is needed. So the justice buses have been in parades, they've been at pride events, they have been at food distribution sites, they've been at rent help clinics and pop-up vaccine clinics. They have been all over the state in really a diverse area. And I just wanted to add on the legal kiosks too, speaking of diversity of our partnerships, those legal kiosks are located in a variety of locations. They're located in domestic violence shelters or with advocates, public libraries, community centers, social services, community action programs, tribal communities. If you ever look at that map on that website, you can see the variety of sites. And we're really proud of the partnerships that we've built with them as well. So those are two key parts of our Reach Justice program. Want to touch on what we've seen for an increased need during the pandemic. So what we've seen is an interconnectedness of legal issues. So when clients come to us, and I'll talk briefly about what these areas of law, they may come with one acute legal issue that they want addressed or that they recognize, but as our lawyers do a holistic screening, they're seeing multiple interconnected issues that we then help clients with, which really adds a lot of need, right? One client comes in, they may have four open files. So if housing is unstable or unsafe, that may lead to problems with education or accessing Wi-Fi or the ability for their kids to attend remote schooling or their child with a disability accessing the services they need for a full educational experience. If housing is unstable, there may be issues with employment, safety issues, Americans with Disabilities Act, reasonable accommodations. And then the other side of the slide, you will see that sometimes when there are housing issues and people weren't allowed to move, that can lead to increased calls with domestic violence. And so we've seen a spike in the number of calls related to domestic violence issues, and those flow to lots of family law issues. Some of the family law issues are, you know, who has the legal right to make medical decisions about children? And a lot of these issues just are interconnected, and these are the types of cases we've seen a real increase in the need for civil legal services, along with lots of areas of law that we've always practiced in. So with those increased needs, what we're seeing is a continued turnaway rate. And then what this is a study that we did in October 2021. So this is extremely recent data. Unfortunately, for every 100 Minnesotans who are low income, have a civil legal need, find our services, apply and qualify for services, 55% of them, 55 out of 100, were saying, I'm sorry, we don't have the resources to serve you. So that's a really unfortunate stat that's been a problem with civil legal services all the time. And it continues to be an issue. And with increased needs, this is not going to get better. There's lots of reasons for that this turnaway rate is high, lack of resources. But circling back to one of the issues that Dory brought up was our salary crisis. And what we've seen in 2021 and 2022 is staff turnover. And 32% of all staff in the last 2 years has left. And we've taken a lot of time and resources to try and hire, to onboard, to train. And that just takes an extreme amount of resources that are then taken away from those client services. And there's a number of reasons for that, but the salary crisis is certainly one of them and one of the key ones. So I'm going to kick it back to Dori on that, and certainly feel free to add anything I missed there, Dori.
Thanks, Anne. The turnover rate is absolutely indicative of what's happening with the salary crisis. That figure is not a sustainable number for civil legal aid to continue moving into the future. We showed you what the current salaries we're hoping to get everybody to on average by July, and that's 60,000. And again, that's not putting us at the table with the other public sector positions for staff attorneys. We have to get move our salary average to 65,000 if we want to stop the bleeding and stop the turnover. And so what we're asking for is an additional 4.3 million. And that will help us get that starting salary average to where it needs to be. And then we're going to continue to work on salary improvement, but we need to get at least there. And something that we have talked about and we'll get to is the need to build capacity as well. And so Civil Legal Services has, and if you want to jump to the next slide, Civil Legal Services has put in a request for American Rescue Plan funds. And so that will allow us, at least temporarily, to look at how we can increase our capacity. So as you see here, we asked for a total of $21,000,567 to spend over the course of three fiscal years. So you can see in FY 2023, we're looking for $7.4 million, followed by just over $7 million in 2024, and then again in 2025, the majority of the funds would be spent on emergency staffing. And so with that money, we would be able to add about 70 FTE across the state to help us respond to this continued increased need that we're seeing as a result of the pandemic, that we're seeing as a result of what Anne articulated, which is everybody's coming in the door with many problems as a result of the pandemic. We're also looking for a portion of the funds to help us continue to support the Reach Justice initiatives. There are many community partners that have reached out and said, hey, we would love to host a kiosk. And so we want to continue to expand the kiosk access and continue to support the technology that allows us to operate in a virtual environment and allows community members that continued safe virtual access to legal services and the system. However, this is 3 years of funding, and it would certainly help. It wouldn't help us meet 100% of the need, but it would help us build capacity to help more of this pandemic need. And so something that the House has asked us, and we want to keep addressing, is what would it take to fully fund civil legal services? And so here it is, like laid out for you. So if you look over to the far left, you'll see where we're at. If you look over to the far right, you'll see that's where we'd need to be. But I want to break it down for you so you kind of understand what it would cost as you move along this trajectory. So with our $4.3 million ask, that would allow us to move to that $22,502 figure. We would stabilize salaries, and we would get our starting salaries for staff attorneys at $65,000 on average. But it would continue to allow us to meet 45% of the need based on the study that Anne cited. However, if we want to build capacity to meet more of the need, then we would have to see an increase in funding. And so then you'd jump over to the 27.853 appropriation. That would help us meet an additional 10% of the need. So if you'd like us to meet 75% more of the need, then you move over and jump up to that 57.5 million figure, right? Salaries are still stabilized, and then we would be able to meet 75% of that need. But the big figure eventually is the 84.2 million in order to get us to meet 100% of the need that we're calculating based on who's contacting us now and who we've had to turn away. And so hopefully that gives you the big picture of how civil legal services needs to meet the needs of the individuals in the state of Minnesota that are so disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. And we are fortunate to have a former, we'll go ahead and move to our contact information if you want to contact Ann or myself. But we are fortunate to have a former client of Civil Legal Services here with us today. So we'll take pause and answer questions after he has an opportunity to address you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for your presentation. I will remind members, because you know we haven't been on Zoom for a while, if you use the raise hand function, we will have some time for questions at the end. But I also want to hear from, former legal aid client. I have Mark Bellario. Mark, if it looks like you're on, if you can unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here with you. My name is Mark Bellario, and I do live in Duluth, Minnesota. And I'd like to tell you briefly about my experiences as a client with legal aid. And so to begin with, I began living in public housing around 2009 because I was working in the senior aid program in the city of Duluth, and I was earning about $400 a month at that time. So public housing was my only option. So at the time of the incident, I had been living in public housing for approximately 3 years, and my income was still very low. But in addition, my son had moved in with me. He was 14 at the time, and I received an eviction notice from the HRA staff. Actually, it was my third eviction notice, but I was able to contact legal aid. But this was obviously a very stressful situation for me because I had no savings and I did not have any other housing alternatives. So I was able to contact legal aid and met with one of their staff attorneys, whose name was Christine Perendo. Besides being able to continue living in public housing, there were additional benefits to my experience with legal aid. One was the impressive way which the attorney was able to skillfully manage the HRA management, because basically there was no resentment as a result of how she handled the, in other words, I felt very comfortable continuing to live in the HRA or in the public housing area where I was living. So that was really important. So secondly, the attorney was able to encourage me personally, because this was a very stressful situation with a 14-year-old child and a single parent. And it was just, she just was able to encourage me and make me feel comfortable about what was going on. That was actually very important for me. Finally, it was clear to me that I would not have been able to handle this situation by myself. You know, just talking to the HRA management, I would not have been able to clarify the situation and bring about a successful resolution. And I would have been facing a very difficult situation with a 14-year-old child and no place to live. Well, that's all I have for you at this time. So I want to thank you for your attention and concern on this matter.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and glad that we could facilitate being able to have you participate, even though you are not in St. Paul. So one of the benefits, I guess, of all of those kiosks. I did have a question from the presentation, and wondering just as far as the kiosks, if you can just highlight a little bit how many there are. You know, I couldn't count really quickly on the map, but it looked like we, you know, geographically they were really spread out. So folks throughout the state, but if you could give us a little more of the statistics on those kiosks, that would be great.
Chairman Griffin, members of the committee, thank you for the question. There are just over 270 legal kiosks across the state right now. And I just want to highlight that the procurement and deployment and putting the software and the interface in place. I mean, this was done in 2 months. It was a rapid undertaking and an incredible collaboration between all the legal aid programs. and if you go to, I know Ann mentioned that the website has the locations option. I encourage everyone to go and look. There are kiosks in so many locations, and they're so important for everyone to be able to send individuals to for assistance. So please check out the website.
Right, thank you. And I thought, Representative Hollins, I think your hand was up if you have a question. Maybe she put it back down.
Yeah. I'm sorry, my internet's going in and out. My question was, what happens to the individuals that don't get service? You said there was, it was either 50 or 55% that don't end up getting service. So what happens to them?
Ms. Rappaport or Ms. Hefkin, whoever wants to take it.
I can take this one. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, Representative Hollins. You know, I think our staff does the best they can to direct the people we turn away to other information or resources. And so sometimes, depending on the situation, we can direct them to a self-help center or to the court forms. But it depends on the legal issue, I think. So it's a classic lawyer answer, right? It depends. Sometimes they're really just stuck and they are left without a remedy to their legal issue. So I don't know if we have data on what happens, but I think, again, our staff is caring and really wishes they could help everyone. So I know that they do their best when it makes sense to refer someone to another source of resources. But oftentimes there isn't an easy answer for people and they are left on their own. And I think the courts see it in people who are unrepresented, and it really does slow down the system when it's a court issue. And sometimes the issue, it can't be resolved with a court and really needs an attorney to write a letter or to find the solution to them, and they are left without that solution.
Any follow-up, Representative Hollins, or does that answer your question?
I think that does answer my question, and I would love to hear more, and you folks are probably not the right people to answer this question, and I really appreciate you being here. But you know, hearing from I've talked to some judges about their experience with pro se litigants and what that does to our legal system and what it does to, you know, just the volume as well as the length of time in processing. And so if you have any comments on that, that would be really great.
Ms. Hefkin or Ms. Rappaport.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you, Representative Hollins. You're right. This would be a good conversation to have directly with the district court judges, with the courts. They can tell you anecdotally what it's like to have so many pro se litigants appear before them. But there is a network statewide. So I mentioned the Law Help MN website. It truly is an incredible website with forms and fact sheets and information that allows people that have to represent themselves to have something with them, to have some clarity on what the process is like. Because let's be honest, the justice system was set up not for lay people. It was set up for lawyers, maybe not even lawyers. Like it's very hard for pro se litigants to figure out processes. And so it is so important for us to also invest in legal information so that if we're not able to represent everyone, if we can't meet 100% of the need, we at least are giving them the information they need to navigate the system as well as they can. And I just want to mention that we also have moved to having additional collaborations with the courts. I will mention that in the 6th Judicial District, for example, there has been a move towards consolidated calendars so that anyone coming into court who is there for an eviction is able to do an intake and have representation and receive legal assistance by legal aid staff. And that's because we have coordinated with the courts, and the courts have said we are vital to be at the table to ensure that there is justice as we continue to face the housing crisis as a result of the pandemic. And so we continue to see those collaborations happening across the state with the courts.
Thank you. And we will have the courts in our committee when we convene on January 31st. We will have them, to give sort of an update as well, and we can ask some questions then. But I think you made some really important points. Members, any other questions for the folks from Civil Legal Services? All right. Very good presentation. I will note, just to remind everyone that the presentation is posted on the website and I believe was emailed out to members. So it is available for the public to look over if they didn't catch all those numbers at the time. So thank you all of you for testifying today. And with that, we'll roll over to the next part of our hearing today. Thank you. All right, so next up, we have the Board of Public Defense, Mr. Kier and Mr. Ward. I imagine you guys might be tag teaming as well. So whoever wants to go first, if you can just introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your presentation, that would be great.
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
I can, Mr. Kier.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble with my audio or with my video, but we will open up and hopefully get us organized here.
And there we go.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yep. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Kevin Kier. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. As you mentioned, Madam Chair, Bill Ward, the State Public Defender, will be also joining in on the presentation in a little bit. So first of all, Madam Chair, thank you and the committee members for the time today, and also for your support over the last several years. Many of the slides, some of the issues that we're going to talk about today are ones that we have presented to you all before, either in budget hearings or overviews. As the folks at Civil Legal had mentioned, they've just become more acute with the pandemic. They become more acute with just the changes that we've seen in society. So just a quick overview, Madam Chair. This year's budget is approximately $106 million. As we have talked to you in the past, personnel amounts to about 90% of that budget. Our mandated costs, about 6%. Public defense corporations, as you can see, and then the other 2%, which is generally case-driven costs. We want to talk a little bit, and Madam Chair, in talking to the staff, talk a little bit about kind of where we are at budget-wise from last year. The pink highlight there, the white pink header, was the original board request for this biennium. You all may recall that at the time the budget was put together in October of 2020, the state was facing about a $7.2 or $7.1 billion budget deficit over the next three-year period. When we put the budget together, or the board put the budget together, we were faced with that reality and faced with the issue of what's something that's reasonable, something that gets the issues out there, but also doesn't raise expectations of folks. So you see that request in the, as I said, in the pink highlight. The actual appropriation in the yellow highlighted box there was a little over $15 million in new money, or roughly $4.2 million less than the original budget request. The request and allocation. The board, as you know, is responsible for allocating the funding that you all provide, or that the legislature provides. If you look over in those columns with the black headings, the board request, you see what our original request was made up of. It included new staff, salary and insurance costs for those staff we already have on board, one-time funding for our caseload backlog, and also funding for our public defense corporations. On the far right, those two columns in the blue, you can see what the board allocated last fall in their budget deliberations, maintaining the funding for the salary and insurance costs, and also for the public defense corporations. The new staffing, Madam Chair, was the staffing for additional support staff. If you can see on this slide, we are right now at roughly 75% of the attorney staff that we should have based on the board's weighted caseload standards. We are at about 60% of where our support staff levels ought to be based on those same standards. The proposal last year was to add those support staff positions that you can see highlighted in blue. It comprised 11 investigator positions, 11 paralegal positions, 15 dispositional advisor positions, and 9 legal secretary positions. We are currently have posted those positions. We are in the process, we're going to start the process of interviewing for those positions.
Mr. Kier, could you just clarify on that last one where it says proposed staffing? So that's what you're doing with the money that was allocated to you. So it's not proposed anymore. It's what you're what we funded you at.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I took the slide out of last year's budget presentation, but that is the actual where we are, what you have funded, and where we're interviewing right now for the position.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. The allocation, if you look at that far right-hand column, you will see the number of attorneys per staff that we're trying to get to. The column just to the left of that is where we are currently. And where we're trying to get to. So it's not an overwhelming number by any means. I actually looked back, and we did a survey of county attorney offices back in 2010. And at that point in 2010, those county attorney offices were at about 1.2 lawyers per support staff. So we're not, again, it wasn't a huge ask, but it makes a huge, huge difference in terms of our ability to deliver services. Madam Chair, you'd ask us about the federal funding and about American Rescue Plan funds. As you heard from the courts, as of this summer, June 30th, there were about 14,000 cases that were backlogged in the courts. Last year, we applied for some reallocation of federal funding through the Department of Public Safety. We were granted $500,000. That money is available through December of this year. And you can see on the slide about $314,000 of that is expended or committed to date. That's one-time money for contract attorneys to again help us with the backlog of cases. We then applied for the Recovery Act funding through MMB in the governor's office, and were granted $3.9 million again for contract attorneys to help us with that backlog of cases. That funding is available through the end of this biennium, so June of 2023. We are paying or trying to pay $60 an hour. I will tell you, and I think Mr. Ward may touch on this a little later, we are having a very difficult time finding contractors to take cases at that rate. Particularly in greater Minnesota, we're having difficulty. A lot of that dealing with the remote access to the courts. Folks are willing to do it and are willing to do it if it's remote. They're not necessarily willing to do it if they have to appear in person, which means shuffling cases between lawyers if in fact there's an in-person hearing. And I will tell you, and I think Mr. Ward will touch on, that's not best practices by any means, but we are trying to do what we can. Madam Chair, a couple of issues that we've talked about again in the past and are much more poignant now. Recruitment is obviously one of them. I pulled this slide from a presentation we did a few years ago to the committee of where we were with our median number of applicants for full-time assistant public defender positions. As you can see, the rural areas, the greater Minnesota areas, the 5th, the 7th, the 9th district have traditionally had difficulty attracting applicants. I then took a look at what our situation was in October through December of this year. And this was just a snapshot of cases or a snapshot of open positions. It does include full and part-time positions, so it's a little different. But you can see where we're at and how we have the number of applicants that have dropped considerably. Even in the 2nd and 4th district, which is Ramsey and Hennepin, those are full-time positions. And so where we were seeing, you know, 70 or 75 or 100 applicants, the last 3 months of last calendar year, we were down to averaging somewhere between 20 and 30 or 32 applicants in those two big metro counties. Just to give you a little idea, I don't want to go through all of these, but you know, some of these are again places where you wouldn't necessarily think we'd have difficulty. Itasca County is Grand Rapids. We had two applicants, one of which was an employee who had been fired just prior to that. Crow Wing County, Brainerd, Beltrami County, Bemidji, Moorhead, St. Cloud. Lyon County is Marshall. Even as I mentioned earlier, this is not just a greater Minnesota issue. It's starting to creep into the metro area as well, with, if you can see, Ramsey, Dakota, and Carver counties as well. The other issue is retention. This is, again, nothing new. We have talked with you all about this before. You have been reading about this in the papers and in online about the great resignation. And we're not immune from that. The two big issues that folks cite when they are leaving are workloads and salary. These are our resignations over the last 4-year period. Again, you can see in 2021, the great resignation has hit us. All in all, when you look at our attrition rate, we will have hired about 40% of our lawyer staff in the last 3 years and about 25% of our support staff in the last 3 years. So it is continuing to be an issue for us. And obviously, for society, as you can see, and as I said, you've read about the Great Resignation. This was an excerpt from a letter that we got from a 7th District public defender. This was an individual who had worked for us part-time, moved to Alaska to be a public defender up in Alaska full-time, and then came back and worked for us again. I won't read through it, but the notes there or the highlights really are the time and stress, and he's tired. And this is one of our shining stars, if you will, in that district. Very good trial lawyer, as he mentioned, been doing this work for a lot of years, still passionate about it, but just as tired. What does that mean, and what does that mean to us as an organization? Just as we, as the folks at Civil Legal talked about, you know, we bring folks in, we train them, they get good at their craft, they improve, and then generally after between years 4 and 7, 3 and 7, we then end up losing them. What has been consistent over the years, particularly over these last 4 or 5 years, is about a third of them, about a third of the folks that leave that identify where they are going, end up going to another public body. You all have actually benefited, gotten a few that are working in with you all in the legislature, county attorney offices, city attorney offices, judicial branch, and some of scatterings to some other public entities. We had talked, Madam Chair, last year about what it would take to get us to where the county attorneys are in terms of salaries. We had provided that information to you all last February. Here's where we're at right now, and the numbers for the county attorneys are a little old. This comes from the annual survey of county attorney offices that the County Attorneys Association does. So as you can see, the average entry level, we have made some improvements. Thanks to you all on this committee and the legislature as a whole, we did make some improvements. That entry level for public defenders was about $55,000 a year 3 years ago. So we did make some improvements there. But we are still lagging in terms of, as people gain experience, where they are going on the salary scale. I will say that we have 17 steps in our assistant public defender salary scale. Generally, the ones that I have seen for county attorneys, there's 12, maybe 10. There may be a few that are fewer than that, but that seems to be kind of where they are at. So not only do we not have the same salary structure or similar structure, it also takes longer for folks to move through that structure. Again, we had talked last year about and provided that information to you all to do something along the lines of this, and moving the salaries into those areas, as I talked about with the county attorneys, would be roughly $21 million a year, between 21 and 22 million. I don't know that I indicated is these are the assistant county attorney positions, again, in those 10 counties where we have our main offices, where we have our district offices. If we're in fact going to do that, there is an issue of salary compression. And I know we talked a little bit about this with the committee last year as well. It isn't just a money issue, although that's the big one. There is a salary cap in statute for the state public defender, which means there's a salary cap for our managing attorneys, our chief public defenders, and also obviously by default, our assistant public defenders. Madam Chair, with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Ward, talk about workloads, caseloads, and kind of client impact that we have seen over the course of the last 18 months or now 20 months with COVID.
All right, well, we'll turn it over to Mr. Ward, and then I see Representative Scott has a question as soon as you wrap up.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, board member, or committee members. For the record, William Ward, I'm the State Public Defender. My goal is to talk about caseloads and workloads, and I'll end with workloads. Before all your eyes glaze over in discussing this, there's a reason for this and there's context to it. When Gideon and the progeny were decided in the 60s and early 70s that afforded the indigent accused the right to have counsel on criminal cases, these case rulings were a premise without a promise. The premise meant that certainly just as in federal court, if you're charged in state court, you should have a lawyer standing by your side. And in fact, you must have one if you are charged and your freedoms are at stake. We at that time, as I think everybody knows, we were a county-based system, and the counties were providing representation to the indigent accused throughout the state of Minnesota. As time went on, ultimately this state, rightfully so, decided to go to a state-based public defender delivery system. We are only one of 26 state-based systems in the entire United States. Others are county-based or a combination of both. In order for us to get there, rightfully so, the legislature wanted a matrix as to, we're not going to give you a blank check. Tell us why you need the money and how the money is going to be used. So ultimately, in the early 90s, prior to us becoming a fully funded statewide system, the Board of Public Defense developed standards and policies, one of which was how many cases should a lawyer have or represent clients on in a given year. This was ultimately based on what they call the Spangenberg study. And some would say, and we've been talking about this on a national level of the last half a decade, that this occurred over a couple of cocktails, and some would say it was more formal in a symposium. But ultimately, the decision was that to be an effective and zealous advocate, a lawyer should not have more than 400 case units. And a case unit ended up being about one misdemeanor per unit. And the reason it became a weighted caseload is because, like we have in some counties in the state, individuals in our office, understandably based upon where they are assigned, have a hybrid caseload, meaning they'll represent clients charged with adult cases, felonies, misdemeanors, and grosses, and potentially also juvenile delinquency cases, and in some respects, kids 10 and over in CHIPS and TPR proceedings. So the board, and I'll just use this for simplicity's sake, said, hey, no more than 400 misdemeanors a year, and no more than 150 to 175 felonies a year. Again, this was adopted by our board in the 90s. The reason that we continue to use this is, or we have used it, is because one, there was a national standard and continues to be so throughout most of the United States. And what we do with that is we come to this committee and to the House and Senate and say, hey, look, this is how many cases we are assigned to in a given year. We average about 150,000 cases per year. And we weight those cases based upon the allegations between felony, gross misdemeanor, and misdemeanor. We ask you for the funding. I'm not even taking into account salaries at this point and pension and other benefits, but the funding is based upon weighted caseload standards. We then, once this legislature chooses to provide a budget to us, the board uses the exact same measure to allot the funding to each of the districts and to allot an attorney client or attorney complement and staffing complement to each of the districts to represent our clients as effectively as we possibly can. So that's the background for all this. Here's the rub with those. Number one, as much as I've been saying this to this committee and to the House and to the Senate and as a whole, we've never been funded to get to the national standard, ever. As I've testified many times over the course of the past decade, cases are falling through the cracks because we don't have sufficient staff to meet the needs of our clients. And the last rub on all this is these standards are incredibly antiquated. They didn't take into account DNA, which has been used forensically since the late 80s and early 90s. electronic and computer forensics, cell phone towers, the use of being able to ping cell phones, the collateral consequences. It wasn't until 2009 with the Padilla decision that immigration wasn't considered a collateral consequence anymore. Deportation wasn't collateral. Now it's something that we have to, as we rightfully should, every case that comes into our system, every client we are appointed to, we have to vet it to determine whether the client is a U.S. citizen. Other collateral consequences. I mean, give you a weird example. When I lived in Chicago and worked at the PD's office there, I never once talked to a client about whether they owned a gun or not, because you couldn't own a gun legally in Chicago. One of the first cases I came when it came up here in 2001 was, can I still have my gun? Collateral consequences on gun ownership, gun possession, ammunition possession, collateral consequences on student, the ability to get student loans, housing, to be a barber, to get a licensing in a salon, to own certain businesses, you name it, the collateral consequences are there because we have literally regulated our citizens to death in these areas. And we need to explain these situations to our clients. Of course, our state has changed since the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We have language and cultural barriers that we need to address. It's not just about, having interpreters. Obviously, it's understanding the culture better, being able to work with and understand our clients and their backgrounds better. Training along those areas, how much time it takes to understand the individual that we're entrusted to serve. Sentencing. Over the past 20 years, the House and Senate have increased mandatory sentencing on any number of cases, the maximum sentence that can be applied, plus mandatory minimums, plus consecutive and permissive type of sentencing as well. Presumptive prison commits didn't exist in the early 80s. Mandatory registration requirements didn't exist, all when caseload standards came about. So our jobs have changed dramatically since the caseload standards were developed and since they were adopted by this board and ultimately changed the way we do our jobs. However,
Mr. Ward, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up so we've got time for questions. We've still got quite a few testifiers today as well.
I sure will. I'm wrapping it up now.
Okay, sounds good.
Just to get us to the national standards, and I've told you where those fall short, we need another 149 lawyers, 25 investigators, 19 paralegals, 17 advisors, 37 legal office assistants, and 14 more managing attorneys. In working the numbers, that would be an additional $29 million just to get to the national standards. That's in positions, and to get the salaries to where they ought to be that Kevin talked about earlier, that's in addition to the other $21 or $22 million that Mr. Kier referenced. So we're talking about a $50 million need for this organization to be at the national standards. I am here to tell you, though, the national standards aren't good enough, and we should be doing better. With the national standards, it assumes that it's okay to just spend, on a misdemeanor, 4.5 hours on that case, or it's okay just to spend 12 to 14 hours on a felony case. If my kid was in trouble, I would expect that lawyer is going to spend more than 12 to 14 hours on a felony matter or 4 hours on a misdemeanor matter. So the funding I'm asking you for gets us to a real basic level, an extra $50 million, which is about 45% of our current funding now. But that gets us to a basic level. And we need to get to workloads. And workloads assumes where some districts are going, keeping time. Where exactly are we spending time? What cases we're spending the time on? Are we spending it more on some driving on some cases or on examining, five or 10, camcorder devices based upon a stop and a seizure? We need to know how we're spending our time so we can better allocate that money and come to you even beyond this $50 million ask as to what our clients truly need for them to be accurately and effectively and zealously represented.
All right. And before you take the slides down, if you could go back to slide 5, just wanted to clarify something.
Let's go to.
So on slide 5, this caseload backlog number, and I just want to clarify too, sort of for the record, as things a lot happened in May and June of last year in, you know, trying to advocate for budget numbers. But, you know, the caseload backlog, the understanding is that that money would be covered by AARP dollars. And I believe in a later slide, you said that that was more than covered with American Rescue Plan dollars. So I just wanted to clarify that that's not something that we left unfunded. It was something that we determined could be covered by the federal dollars.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It was a process, obviously, to go through to apply to get that money, but there was the discussion of, hey, the money's out there, go and look, apply for it. The reason you see the difference in those two is this number was put together in October of 20, and obviously by the time we got to June, those numbers had increased significantly.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And then I also just want to clarify that when we're negotiating to try to get a bigger number for the Board of Public Defense, it isn't, we don't choose as a legislature whether that goes to new staff or salary increases. It's just a solid number that we're advocating for public defense. And now we'll get to questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this goes, my questions go back to Mr. Kyer's presentation. One was the first one would be the slide on the federal dollars, the different buckets there. Yeah, it's towards the front of the right there. Yeah.
Yep, sorry.
So, and this is probably related to the chair's question about the backlog, but that 3.9 million of ARA funding, is that Mr. Kyer or Kyer, that's going to be used to address the backlog? Is that correct?
Correct.
Mr. Kyer.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Okay. Then my other question was further along in the presentation, and it was the two blue green bar graphs. One of, yeah, this one, that number 10, I believe. Nope, that's not it. Nope, keep going. It was a comparison. It showed the number of people that you were losing and then where they were going. Then you, this one right there, 14. So in that you have, nope, that's not it either. Well, it's where the green bar represented where they went to another government agency or a public agency. Is this one? Oh, yeah, this is it. Okay. So just wondering, just out of curiosity, why you put the green bar there, why it was necessary, you thought it was important to put that they moved to a public entity on this graph versus just having it strictly be resignations.
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I felt it was important because, again, if you go back to the slide that we had or the issue we had in terms of retention and saying we're losing folks not necessarily to the private sector, we're losing them to other public entities, and it goes back to the issue of salary and workloads.
Okay. I was just, and I must have missed when you said that.
I'm sorry.
Specific piece about the private, and that's not your fault. That's on me, I'm sure. But I just was curious why that comparison, because it's like, well, that necessarily probably means that either those people aren't working at all or they went to the private sector. So thank you for that. That's all.
And again, those are the folks that identified, right? Sometimes
yeah,
they don't.
Yeah, you don't, right. Sure. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Hollins, and then we'll get to our additional testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the presenters. This was really informative and helpful. I am genuinely disturbed that with the 4.5 hour expectation for misdemeanors, having practiced law previously, I know that like at least an hour and a half of that is usually just the person explaining what has happened to them and not even getting into legal strategy. So that is really terrifying. My question really is, have you folks ever asked for the full amount of funding that you would need to completely, you know, for full funding, to completely staff everything that you need, every program that you have, and to make sure that you are functioning as as efficiently and as well-oiled as possible.
Mr. Ward?
Madam Chair, the short answer would be no. Representative Hollins, you weren't here then, I don't think. Well, certainly you weren't in the House. We faced a deficit. Our budget was cut in 2008, 9, and 10. I laid people off. I laid off 17% of my staff. That doesn't mean that we haven't testified either in my capacity as a chief public defender, the 10th or in the 4th district, or a state public defender about why we're asking what we're asking for, understanding that there are two bodies of government of the House and the Senate, and understanding this is what we need. We've always told this body of what the national standards are. We've always told the body this is what we're trying to get to. And it took us 6 years just to get back to the deficit that we were faced with in the late first part of the decade. And we were brutally honest with this body and the Senate that it was a six-year plan just to get us back to where we should be at. So, you know, we've never asked for an additional $50 million, but we have certainly been very, very upfront about the national standards, where this gets us to, that we got finally, from, the level we were before, the average caseload to where we are now, which isn't good enough, but we're still at 60% of our support staff level. We need to get better there. We didn't ask for the huge grab, but there's been no secrets about what we need, what our clients desperately need, and that we face, challenges of being ineffective because of us being short in budget.
All right. Thank you. And I will say that asking for what you need to meet a standard would not be a big grab, but actually meeting the needs of Minnesotans. So thank you for that question, Representative Hollins, and thank you for your presentation. And I'm sure you guys will be available for questions, remotely once this committee wraps up if folks still have questions. And with that, I'm going to get to our other testifiers today. I have public testimony. First on the list, I have Kara Gilbert. Kara, if you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Kara Gilbert, she, her pronouns. I am an assistant public defender in Ramsey County. My clients are the ones who suffer when I cannot adequately do my job. They suffer because I don't have the time that I need to build relationships with them and thoroughly read, watch, research, and litigate their cases. To be clear, my appointment is mostly representing juveniles. So when I say that it takes time for me to develop relationships with my clients, it takes time. I have been a PD for 7 years between here and Colorado. I, prior to that, spent 20 years as a special education teacher. I went to law school at night. I was teaching and going to law school and doing clerkships on my school breaks. I currently make less than the starting salary in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. Money is not why I do what I do, but the impact of a low salary is real. For me personally, it meant that leaving an abusive marriage meant filing bankruptcy and qualifying for the federal minimums on bankruptcy. I have a friend, an attorney in my office who lives in Section 8 housing. I have many friends in my office, attorneys, who live paycheck to paycheck, who drive cars that either need to be repaired or replaced and can't be because the money isn't there. None of that is the real cost of us not being able to do what we need to do. My clients, our most vulnerable citizens, primarily children of color, bear the brunt and the real cost. If you don't pay competitively, you can't fill positions and keep attorneys. There are two new county attorneys in Ramsey Juvenile, hired just this year. Both were offered positions in our office. Both of them declined those positions and cited the salary differences. Both of them are men of color, which is desperately needed among our attorneys. Our caseloads continue to climb, and they can't fill the positions, so they hire contract attorneys. Those are expensive. They make more per hour than any of the rest of us, and they can't hire them even at what they're offering. and they aren't around to do the job. Recently in Ramsey County, a contract attorney appeared on the record with a client, pled that client without a plea agreement to a commit felony, to a felony where the presumptive sentence is prison, again, without a plea agreement, and said to the judge, the next attorney will have to make the departure argument because my contract is up. Even working nights and weekends without extra pay or comp time, we can't meet client needs, adequately review discovery, research legal issues, write motions, and litigate the issues. If we don't have time to build the client relationships, and it takes a lot of time, they won't tell us what we need to know to represent them. If we aren't watching body camera, we don't see the things, the issues that we need to raise. We don't see the need of the ribs when the client is on the ground. We don't see the gap where the video turns off and then turns on and the client has new bruises. We don't hear the actual conversation that was used to justify the search, to expand the scope, and on and on. We are a critical part of the solution to policing in Minnesota, but not if we can't do our jobs well, not if we can't blow the whistle when we need to. Once one of these issues is missed or one of our clients waives their rights, we can't unring that bell. There's nothing we can do to get that back, and it's our clients who suffer for it. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Ginny Barron. Ms. Barron, if you can unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ginny Barron, and I am a public defender in the 5th District, which is the southwest corner of our state. I have been a public defender for approximately 10 years. I became a public defender because I grew up poor in Minneapolis, and I know from my own firsthand family experience how life-changing a zealous, competent attorney can be, especially for those who don't have the money to pay for an attorney. Today, I do that job with a heart that keeps me in touch with my humanity. And I come to you today both in my individual capacity and as a voice for the clients that I represent. The most plain way I can say it is that the Board of Public Defense has a retention and recruitment problem resulting from low pay and working conditions that are directly impacting our clients. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about. Clients are being forced to sit in jail longer because we can't keep qualified people. Our pay structure is significantly less than those at the Attorney General's office and the prosecuting attorney offices across the state. In my district alone, a new attorney coming in straight out of law school will be paid over $20,000 more to work for the Blue Earth Prosecutor's Office than they would the Board of Public Defense. In Martin County, that's almost a $25,000 gap. We get positions and we have to repost them because we don't get applicants. I remember when I started 10 years ago, it was a competitive process and a coveted job, but that's no longer the case. The morale is the lowest I have ever seen it in my 10 years. Off the top of my head, I can think of 9 separate people in my district who left being public defenders, good, competent, amazing public defenders, to go take a job with the Attorney General's office or a local prosecuting office because of the pay disparity and the working conditions. The Board of Public Defense has not made it a priority to pay our people adequate wages, even when they've been given the money to do so. As Mr. Kier earlier testified, it isn't just a money issue, but there's also a compression issue. Well, I want to tell this committee on behalf of every client I represent that my clients could care less about compression issues and find it offensive that their rights are being imposed upon so that those at the top do not have to see a salary compression. They hire contract attorneys to do half the work at often twice the pay, and we end up most of the time getting a majority of those cases back and having to deal with them. To make matters worse for our clients, management is refusing to authorize comp time to allow our attorneys that we do have to try and to continue provide client-centered representation in an ethical way. Instead, management is telling us to spend less time on each of our cases. I've not only been told this, but I've been giving this in writing in emails. I'm happy to provide any of that if it's requested. When I asked how to accomplish spending more time or less time on each of my cases, I was told not to review all the evidence in my cases. I was told not to watch the DVDs and the CDs in our cases, and I believe that Kira adequately addressed the problems with that. I have clients that are being held in jail longer because they can't have experienced and trained attorneys that are staying with us. And then it snowballs. Management tells us that the solution to this that I have received is to tell clients that they have to waive their rights, that they have to waive their rights to things such as a speedy trial or hearings within timelines, even as they sit in custody and are presumed innocent. I've been told by management that I can tell and advise my clients that they really only have one of three options. They can, one, represent themselves and fire us. Two, they can hire a private attorney. Or three, they must waive their rights to timely hearings and speedy trials and sit in jail for weeks to months longer waiting for those hearings and trials. As the survey indicates, over three quarters of attorneys who responded to the survey say that we do not have the time necessary to review all the discovery in our case. We don't have the time to talk to our clients. We don't have the time to meet with our clients in jail sufficiently. Clients are given sometimes just mere minutes to decide if they want to go back home with their family or if they want to enforce their rights, their constitutional rights, which means that we have innocent people who are pleading guilty or pleading to charges that are more severe simply because they want to be able to get back with their families instead of having to sit needlessly in jail waiting for their public defender to be able to adequately represent them. Until the Board of Public Defense starts prioritizing asking for the necessary funding and paying its current staff adequate comparable wages with the money it does have, the retention issue is only going to get worse, and the recruitment issue will suffer that same fate. When you throw in the working conditions of management refusing to approve comp time to allow us to be able to do our jobs, the jobs that we are hired to do, that we're passionate to do, that we want to do, until management.
Ms. Barron, we've got two more people that need to testify. If you can wrap up, please.
Yep. So that's the reality of what my clients face. So on behalf of every client that I have represented, I ask you to please, please, please address the retention issue and provide the money necessary to allow us to do our job so our clients are not the ones bearing the brunt and their personal freedoms are not being violated. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Andrea Anderson. Ms. Anderson, if you can take yourself off mute, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee, good afternoon. I am Andre Anderson, and I use she, her pronouns. I have worked for 9 years as a legal office assistant in the 4th Judicial District, which comprises Hennepin County. Those accused of crimes have a constitutional right to legal counsel to defend themselves. I choose to work in public defense because I believe that everyone accused is entitled to receive the quality and level of representation that our office seeks to provide. Using the person felony team that I work on as an example, each morning, our office's service begins with a legal office assistant preparing documents for potential clients to review during their initial one-on-one meeting with a licensed attorney. All of the attorneys that we send to interview potential clients have been certified to practice law by the Minnesota Board of Law Examiners. Potential clients are guaranteed to meet with an attorney who has many years of criminal defense trial experience. During the initial interview with a potential client, our experienced criminal defense attorney has at his or her disposal a team of professional investigators who are available to immediately follow up, if in person if needed, on any information that may be relevant to the potential client's defense. After the initial interview, in the morning, our experienced criminal defense attorney prepares a thorough and rigorous argument for bail that he or she will present in court that afternoon, if the potential client agrees to proceed with our services. If a potential client chooses to be represented by one of our experienced criminal defense attorneys, they can be confident that their case will receive individual attention from an experienced team of professional investigators paralegals, and law clerks. Our services also include unlimited calls to our office to follow up with any questions, concerns, or any additional information that the client may need. Our legal office assistants work as liaisons between the clients and their experienced criminal defense attorneys. Depending on volume, our legal office assistants can talk to each client personally and notify the experienced criminal defense attorney of the updated information. I am so sorry to tell you that I am afraid the exceptional criminal defense services that our office provides to clients entrusted to our care at the most vulnerable times in their lives are in jeopardy of being lost. I have personally witnessed experienced criminal defense attorneys, legal office assistants, paralegals, investigators, and dispositional advisors leave reluctantly, some without jobs to even go to, because they did not feel that they were able to provide the level of service that our clients are entitled to. I love my job. I love that I get to witness the protections guaranteed in the Constitution demanded for our clients every day. I am humbled by and in awe of the level of dedication that those that I work with have. I would like to say that I feel that we are rowing in a boat, but the oars are not all there. We're losing rowers. How are we going to get to the finish line and do the best that we can if we don't have what we need? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson, for your testimony. Finally, we have Brenda Lightbody. If you could unmute yourself and then introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me address you here today. My name is Brenda Lightbody. I'm a three-quarter time public defender in the First Judicial District, and currently I work in Dakota County. I've been a public defender for just over 20 years. I was full-time for 15 years, and I've been three-quarter time for just about 5 years. In the public defender's office, three-quarter time public defenders are allowed to also have a private caseload. However, my public defender caseload prevents me from pursuing much private work. My public defender caseload is and should be my priority. I, like many of my colleagues, am drowning. The caseloads are brutal, and so is the workload. I am essentially working full-time. The demands put on us by the judicial system impact the clients we serve. The requirements of this job extend beyond knowing the law. We are part social workers, part therapists, part friend, part parent, part magician, and part lawyer. We visit clients in jail. We do Zoom hearings. We appear in person in court. We do trials. We answer questions. We are Jills and Jacks of all trades. As Mr. Ward said, we are expected to know a lot about a lot of different areas, and yet we are not adequately compensated for that knowledge and experience. We cannot continue to be zealous advocates under these current conditions. Our primary focus is upon upholding the constitutional rights of our clients. Yet that focus is obscured by low pay, low morale, and attorneys leaving the public defender's office in droves. I know I speak for many of my colleagues when I say we are exhausted. The pandemic and the backlog have illuminated problems brewing for years. Our frustration is about inadequate compensation compared to prosecutors, but it's more than that. It's about a system that doesn't support us, that indeed often bullies us. Though told that we are justice partners, all too often, that seems like an oxymoron of epic proportions. I could cite numerous other examples, and some have, but here are only a few. The Board of Public Defense, my own agency, could help by, yes, hiring more lawyers, and we must cultivate new lawyers, yet retain and reward experienced lawyers. This is not an either-or scenario, and hiring temporary contract lawyers is not a viable solution, especially when they are paid so much more than we are. Based on what Mr. Kyer said, I should quit and then get reappointed as a contract attorney to earn more money than I do now. The judicial system is not equipped to deal with the plethora of mental health issues, which have only increased during the pandemic. You, the legislature, could also help us by refining the appointment process. All too often, judges are appointing us to represent clients absent financial inquiry because it is easier for them. We are not meant to represent everyone, and it is not the fault of the men and women in the public defender's office that there is a backlog of cases. All too often, judges push resolution on us based on the backlog by saying, we have to resolve these cases, Ms. Lightbody. That is nothing more than a euphemism of saying your client should plead guilty. While many, and indeed most cases, do resolve through plea negotiations, the push to resolve cases deprives our clients of the time, attention, research, and inquiry that each client deserves under the Constitution. We are being asked to do more and more and more. We are frustrated and burned out, not unlike teachers who are also making a mass exodus from their profession. We feel unsupported by our own agency and the judicial system in general. While I am getting close to retirement, I know of at least three or four attorneys in my office actively seeking employment, and others have addressed the mass resignations. And we have trouble attracting new attorneys to open positions. This compounds the frustration and is ultimately a problem for our clients. Unhappy and stressed and demoralized public defenders cannot properly serve our clients. And be clear, we want to serve our clients. This is not an easy or glamorous job. It is a hard and thankless one. We are drawn to this work for myriad reasons: to uphold the Constitution, to speak truth to power, to hold the state to their burden, to seek justice. We are fighters, we are sympathetic, we are caring, we are oppositional defiant, and we are champions of the underdogs. Our clients often come from generations of dysfunction, poverty, low cognition, drug and alcohol dependency. They challenge us. At times, indeed, they frustrate us, but they always inspire us to be better advocates and better lawyers. When we are overwhelmed, we cannot do our jobs. When we are stretched so thin as we are now, our clients suffer. When our mental health is challenged, our clients suffer. When we are bullied by the system, our clients suffer. When we are asked to do more with less, our clients suffer. And many of us are saying, I can't do this anymore. An assembly line system of McJustice is not a good system. We cannot churn and burn through experienced personnel. The eyes of the country, indeed the world, are watching Minnesota. Our public defender system is the envy of many, but that system is in peril. I got into this work and stay in it because I love the Constitution. I believe in the Constitution. I love being in the courtroom. I love fighting for our clients, and I believe in the tenets of guilty until proven innocent. But I'm weary and frustrated. Many of us are. It is my honor to speak here today and represent the men and women who do this job. They are among the finest lawyers in the business, and almost without exception, some of the finest human beings that I know. Funny, smart, tenacious, kind, and resilient, but hurting and overwhelmed. Thank you for listening to me here today, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony, and we do need to wrap in 2 minutes. So I do want to thank everyone for listening today and attending this hearing. I think it's really important to hear from kind of the boots on the ground folks. And to end, I'll just sort of, you know, remind us that, you know, two of the bedrock principles of our justice system in America are that a person is innocent until proven guilty, and that that we require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, those are things that we depend on in our system. And our Constitution requires that states provide legal representation to the people who need it because they can't otherwise afford it. And so I think it's important to hear that, hear from folks. Representative Scott, you've got 10 seconds. You've got a quick question.
Yep, real quickly, Madam Chair, just wondering, since this is a pre-session hearing, is the intent of the chair then is to have a supplemental or another budget this year, since we're hearing kind of budget items? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good question, Representative Scott. I fully expect that we will be seeking supplemental budget items this year, given the surplus and everything else that's going on. And obviously what we heard today, the need that is there. So, but we'll stay in touch as we get closer to session. And again, thank you everybody for your time, and thank you for our testifiers. Have a good rest of your day. Thanks.